KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Yesterday's Supreme Court decision striking down Washington, D.C.'s handgun ban is already having ramifications. The National Rifle Association plans to file suit seeking to overturn a San Francisco ordinance that bans the possession of firearms in public housing projects, and other city and state gun regulations may also soon be challenged. In the hour ahead, we'll talk about the court ruling, the wave of lawsuits that will now follow, and the overall implications for the Bay Area and for California. That's ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Rarely have 26 words been so debated. The Second Amendment, and it reads as follows. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Yesterday's Supreme Court ruling on what those 26 words mean struck down Washington, D.C.'s gun law, which banned handguns from the home and strictly regulated how other guns were kept and stored. In so doing, the court ratified for the first time the individuals have the right to bear arms, not just state militias. But the 5-4 ruling also stated that while Washington, D.C.'s regulations were too strict, not all gun restrictions were out of bounds. So what's next? Well, more lawsuits, for one. Gun laws in many cities and states around the country will now be challenged, including here in San Francisco, where a city ordinance prohibits the possession of firearms in public housing projects. The National Rifle Association is challenging that ordinance by filing suit today. And joining us first this morning to discuss that challenge is Chuck Michel. He's an attorney representing the NRA. Mr. Michel, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. In a word, what is the essence of why you want to challenge this specific housing regulation, public housing ordinance in San Francisco?
Well, if you really want it in one word, the answer is incorporation. And by that I mean right now the Heller decision only...
The Heller decision meaning what the Supreme Court did yesterday?
The Supreme Court ruling from yesterday in the Heller case only restricts the federal government. The next question and the threshold question that needs to be answered before you really get into scrutinizing whether or not other gun control ordinances or statutes are constitutional or not is whether or not the Second Amendment also restricts actions by state and local governments.
And that's because, of course, Washington, D.C. is a federal entity, and so now you want to pursue that at the city and state level. What is it specifically about San Francisco's regulation that guns can't be owned in a public housing project do you specifically want to challenge?
Well, we want to challenge that policy and that ordinance. San Francisco has an ordinance that has been manifested in the public housing lease that says residents cannot possess any firearm in their own home. That's handguns, long guns, anything. Doesn't matter if it's locked up, unloaded. There are no exceptions. You can't have a handgun. So in that sense, although it doesn't apply citywide, it only applies in those residences that are part of public housing. It's actually broader than the D.C. laws were.
And would it be your assessment then, I assume, that you would take encouragement from what the court ruled yesterday, that this is the kind of tightly restrictive policy that would fall from the court's decision yesterday?
Right. This is a complete ban on handguns in one's own home. A complete ban on firearms, all types of firearms, in one's own home. So it's broader than D.C. in some respects. So, and that's exactly what was struck down yesterday by the Supreme Court. So the only real difference is that this is an action by a local government as opposed to the federal government, and that's exactly the question that we want answered. Does the Second Amendment restrict those local ordinances as well?
And also in terms of the court's decision yesterday, they also seem to take exception to the fact that in Washington, D.C., that if you had guns other than handguns, they had to be stored in a very secure way, disabled, some would say, by way of trigger locks. Those ordinances are also, of course, on the books in San Francisco and other places. Do you see that as lawsuit number two?
I, the short answer to that is I don't know. That's certainly one ordinance that we're looking at very hard, but there are probably other things that might come first. I mean, the bottom line is the threshold question is to answer the incorporation issue, and then from there, we'll probably all get together and, I mean, self-defense civil rights lawyers from across the country and talk about what the next move should be after we see what happens with incorporation. And by the way, the incorporation case being brought in San Francisco is not the only case being brought nationally. There's been one filed in Chicago already. There'll be several more filed in Illinois. So there's sort of a plan in place to get this issue resolved first, and then everything will be on the table and we'll have a look. That's not to say that, you know, that every gun law is vulnerable. There are lots of gun laws that are not vulnerable to constitutional challenge, that are perfectly constitutional, because as the Supreme Court said, no fundamental right is absolute, and that includes the Second Amendment just like the First Amendment.
Chuck Michel, an attorney representing the NRA, who will be filing suit today in San Francisco challenging the San Francisco ordinance which prohibits the possession of firearms in public housing projects. Mr. Michel, thanks for starting us out this morning.
Hey, my pleasure.
Joining us now for the balance of our hour to take up this question more fully, what the Supreme Court did yesterday and what the implications of it are for San Francisco and the rest of the state of California, are Kamala Harris. She's the district attorney, of course, for the city and county of San Francisco. She filed an amicus brief supporting the Washington, D.C. gun law. Ms. Harris, good morning.
Good morning, Dave.
Thanks for being with us. Joining us, too, are Eugene Volokh. He is a professor of constitutional law at UCLA. He filed an amicus brief opposing the Washington, D.C. restrictions. Professor Volokh, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be on.
Thanks for being with us. And Alan Ides joins us as well. He's professor of constitutional law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Professor Ides, good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for being with us all. Kamala Harris, first, since this challenge will arrive on your doorstep here in San Francisco and you'll have to contend perhaps with what will take place, what's your reaction to this first argument, which is that the next step in all of this is to figure out whether or not the Supreme Court's decision applies to cities and states because, of course, Washington, D.C. is this peculiar federal entity?
Overall, I think what's going to happen now, unfortunately, as a result of the Heller ruling, is that there is going to be a slippery slope. And the first attack is going to be based on this issue, as your last guest outlined. And next, it will be attacking our local legislation restricting gun owners to in requiring that they keep their guns in locked boxes. And frankly, I have to tell you that here in San Francisco, we are absolutely prepared to fight any attempt to turn this decision into a slippery slope that ultimately may threaten our ability to prosecute gun crime.
And what is the essence of why you think the specific regulation about banning possession of handguns or any kind of gun in a public housing project, why that's important in terms of crime and safety in San Francisco?
Well, over the last 2 years, 80% of our homicides took place occurred because of a gun. Guns kill. And we are seeing through gun shows happening at the Cow Palace on county property, we are seeing through a black market. Guns are everywhere, and they are a particular issue in the housing projects where we are seeing a great deal of crime. And there are families living in those communities who want to be safe and want regulation around criminal activity. And there is a strong connection between criminal activity and the proliferation of guns in that community.
Kamala Harris, District Attorney for San Francisco. Eugene Volokh, again, first on this question of applying it to cities and states versus just a federal entity like Washington, D.C. Do you see that as step number one, and as Kamala Harris suggests, once that particular issue perhaps is resolved, that we'll see a whole nother wave of challenges too?
There will be challenges. I think it'll be a relatively modest wave of challenges. And I think most gun laws will be upheld. But I do think that the court will probably say that the Second Amendment, like the First Amendment, the Fourth and the Fifth, and at least most of the Fifth and the Sixth, and most of the Bill of Rights, applies to state and local governments through the 14th Amendment, which constitutionalized for state and local governments the federal Bill of Rights. So I think this will be an issue that San Francisco and Chicago and other places will face. If there are modest restrictions on guns,
then they will generally be upheld. We have the experience from about 40 states have individual right to keep and bear arms provisions in their state constitutions, clearly aimed at self-defense. So there's nothing that new at recognizing a federal such right. And in those states, a lot of gun laws have been challenged. Virtually all of them have been upheld, except the really broad bans, which as to which some of them have been struck down. With the public housing, I suppose the city could argue that it's power as property owner over the public housing is greater than its power as regulator. So even if it couldn't, say, ban guns from all homes in San Francisco, it could ban it from those homes that it owns as a public housing owner. My guess is the court isn't going to go along with that for much the same reason that the court wouldn't accept a Fourth Amendment argument along those lines. Imagine that the city said, because we want to fight crime, we're going to have unannounced, warrantless, probable causeless searches of every apartment in our public housing complexes. Would that help fight crime? Quite possibly. Would it violate the Fourth Amendment? Nearly certainly. In some respects, the Bill of Rights protects people even against the government's attempts to fight crime. And incidentally, I take it that quite a few people in public housing projects may want to have weapons to defend themselves against crime. So my guess is that the San Francisco public housing possession ban is so broad that it's going to be one of the few gun controls that actually will be struck down.
And Alan Ives, how do you see that? Do you see this particular ordinance in San Francisco as being particularly vulnerable based on what the Supreme Court did yesterday?
I think it is vulnerable, and I agree with what Professor Bollock said. I think it quite likely that the Supreme Court will hold that state and local governments are subject to the Second Amendment. I don't agree with that interpretation, but I think the majority certainly hinted in a footnote that it would be looking in that direction, and logically that seems like the next step for the majority to take. And so I do think that public housing ban on possession of weapons will be struck down. I think it quite likely. I agree with Professor Volokh that there are obviously additional arguments to be made, but I also agree that if a constitutional limit does apply to limit the power of the state, such as the Fourth Amendment, that the Second Amendment will be applied in the same fashion. So an absolute ban on weapons in public housing is... seems to me facing a pretty high hurdle at this time.
And Kamala Harris, outline for us how you'll climb over that high hurdle.
Well, we're going to make an argument that there's a reasonable connection between the regulation and a legitimate government purpose, which is keeping the community safe. But I don't disagree with the law professors that it will be a high hurdle, as you have mentioned. And our concern, again, is that it is important that we as local government and government in general be allowed to have common sense regulations on gun ownership and possession. And again, I believe that this decision, the Heller decision yesterday, is now opening the door to a great deal of confusion about these regulations. It will result in litigation, clearly. And as we have seen with the interpretation of the First Amendment over 200 years, a lot of litigation will follow. And in the process, though, we may see an erosion of what I think have been common sense regulations as it relates to guns.
If the ruling on public housing is sort of chapter one in what you've described as a potential slippery slope, let's talk then about chapter two. If it's going to be difficult to hold on to San Francisco's regulation regarding banning the possession of guns in public housing projects, what about the next step, things like trigger locks? Where does that fall in this continuum of possibilities?
Well, exactly right. That will be the next step, I'm sure. And let's talk about the law that we have in place that would be challenged next. We passed legislation in San Francisco in the last couple of years requiring that gun owners keep the gun in a locked box in their home. Why? Well, children often get access to guns in the home and they harm themselves and sometimes have killed themselves. Why do we have this legislation? Because also we know that in a great number of home burglaries, the burglar grabs the gun knowing that it will achieve some nice dollar amount on the black market, and they go out and they sell it. And that gun ends up in the hands of a criminal.
So for you, this would be the epitome of the kind of reasonable gun law that you think ought to stand.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is absolutely a reasonable, there's a reasonable relationship between this regulation on the gun owner's right to own and have the gun in their home, and the need to create safe communities and do what we can to ensure public safety.
And Alan Ives at Loyola Law School, how do you see that particular case? Will it also have a high hurdle in terms of being held onto by the city of San Francisco?
Well, I think it'll have a significantly lower hurdle. If I could return to the Supreme Court's opinion in Heller, which, by the way, I happen to disagree with. I think the dissent had the stronger argument on the text of the Second Amendment and on the original intent. But that being said, the majority wrote a fairly narrow opinion. It made it very clear that a wide array of gun regulations would be upheld as reasonable. It was holding simply that an absolute ban on the possession of weapons in the home was unconstitutional. It gave a small list, which it said was not exclusive, of regulations pertaining to gun ownership, including the commercial sale of guns, that would be upheld. So my feeling is that the Supreme Court has essentially done two things. It said we're taking one item off the table, an absolute ban on the possession of guns. That's no longer part of the discussion. We recognize, though, that gun violence is a problem, and we recognize that it needs a political solution, and as long as government, and I presume state and local governments, act reasonably, those regulations are going to be upheld. So I think the decision doesn't invite the slippery slope. It does invite litigation. We're going to have to work out what we mean by reasonable. But given that it's a 5-4 decision and the swing vote was Justice Anthony Kennedy, who is kind of a notorious balancer, I expect that a majority of the court, even if it stays in this configuration, is going to uphold most of the gun regulations that come before it.
And Eugene Volokh at UCLA, how do you see whether or not the trigger lock requirement in particular fits in that continuum?
I do agree that the court would be willing to uphold a considerable range of reasonable regulation. The difficulty is that many of the people who are in favor of pretty broad gun controls label virtually anything a reasonable regulation. Unless I'm mistaken, I believe that the San Francisco attorney labeled the total ban on public housing, on guns in public housing, a total ban on all guns as a reasonable regulation. Clearly, that can't be reasonable by the standards that the court's interpretation of the Second Amendment right requires. When we get to something more modest like trigger locks, I think the court will look to several things. One is it'll look to the scope of the regulation. If the regulation is, for example, limited to those homes in which there are children, say, under the age of 14 or some such, then in that case, I think the court would be more likely to uphold it because it could say, look, this is something that is justified by a special interest over and above the sort of interest of that the government can assert in every single gun case. Likewise, if, for example, somebody is able to keep the gun loaded in a safe where just a few button pushes are going to open it up, then I think a court might be, it all depends, but might be willing to say, look, if there's evidence that it can be opened in 3 seconds by somebody who knows the combination, then in that case the burden on people's ability to defend themselves is relatively modest. On the other hand, if the rule is all guns must be kept locked and unloaded, whether or not there's a child around because we're so worried about gun theft or something along those lines, I think a court would probably say that this goes beyond a reasonable regulation.
Well,
it's important to realize that reasonable can't mean here that reasonable people can differ as to whether it makes sense. I oppose most gun controls, but I certainly agree that there are reasonable arguments in favor of even a total ban on all guns. Reasonable people can and have argued in favor of that. Reasonableness must mean the kind of regulation that imposes a relatively modest and well-justified burden on the right, as opposed to something that comes closer to a total ban or to a very serious burden on ability to possess the gun and use it for self-defense. Similar things come up, for example, in abortion rights in a variety of other contexts.
Right.
The question of what the magnitude of the burden is on the right.
Let's tackle then the question of reasonableness on trigger locks, Kamala Harris, and whether or not there are trigger locks and there are trigger locks, or lock boxes and lock boxes. You heard Eugene Volokh say that there are variations with that, and one might be reasonable and one might not be. How does San Francisco fit into that?
We're quite reasonable. in terms of where we are in San Francisco, is we have obviously legislation that has put restrictions on gun ownership and possession. And I think, have very good reason for having the legislation that we do. And it will be, as everyone has agreed, subject to a court's review, using a reasonableness standard as opposed to a strict scrutiny standard. I think there's some consensus about that, which is good. And we will see where we stand. And obviously, we're going to have to make the argument that on balance, our local government's concern and need for this restriction outweighs the individual right to own and possess that gun.
Do you see the possibility, though, that in San Francisco, I don't know what the specifics are of the ordinance that controls the way in which guns have to be locked and secured, but that might have to be modified? Professor Volokh seemed to be suggesting that if you can get into that lockbox readily, then it's reasonable. If it's really difficult, it might not be. Is that the kind of thing that may also have to be adjusted in order to meet the court's decision?
I have no doubt that those arguments will be made. And, and then the argument may go to, well, is such a box available? Is there the technology to have such a box that can be secure and safe and, push one button and the thing pops open? The point that he made about 14-year-olds or children under a certain age, if they are in the home, then that justifies more regulation. I think that would be reasonable as an argument to make before a court, and it probably, that argument will be made.
Ellen Ides, you said that you disagreed with the court's decision. We just have a minute before we go to the break. But from your position as a constitutional lawyer, just give us your quick brief on why you think the court made the wrong choice.
I think they made the wrong choice, though I would say it was a close question. I think they made the wrong choice because the Second Amendment appears to operate more as a federalism type of principle that guarantees to the states the right to maintain a militia. I found Justice Stevens' arguments with respect to the concern about standing armies to be very persuasive. And as a consequence, it seems to me that the Second Amendment, like the Establishment Clause, in fact, was meant to limit the ability of the federal government to interfere with the states. It has been transformed by the majority into a right to possess firearms for purposes of self-defense. Again, there's a plausible argument for that, and so we have to live with that decision. But I think Stevens had it right.
Ellen Ides, professor of constitutional law at the Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. He joins us along with Eugene Volokh at UCLA and Kamala Harris, district attorney for San Francisco. When we come back, we'll take your calls and questions on this topic. We know this is the kind of topic in which people more often than not have opinions as opposed to questions, but we'd like your questions for our distinguished guests on this matter, what you'd like to hear them respond to in terms of the consequence of yesterday's Supreme Court decision. We'll be back to take your calls in just a moment. Here's the number. If you'd like to join us, it's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. Back with more with our guests in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the consequence of yesterday's United States Supreme Court, which struck down Washington, D.C.'s ban on the possession of handguns within the district. We are joined this morning by Kamala Harris, district attorney for San Francisco, Eugene Volokh, professor of constitutional law at UCLA, and Ellen Ides, professor of constitutional law at the Loyola Law School. We welcome your questions and thoughts on this topic as well. You can join us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Before the break, Ellen Ides, you were outlining some of the reasons why you thought the court got it wrong, that it was a tough call, tight decision. decision where there was not a lot of margin in terms of what the right call would be, but you think that on balance they got it slightly wrong. And I want to read you something from Justice Scalia, who wrote the majority opinion, and get your take on it. He wrote that some think the Second Amendment is outmoded in a society where gun violence is a serious problem. That is perhaps debatable, but what is not debatable is that it is not the role of this court to pronounce the Second Amendment extinct. So within that framework, he seems to be saying it's true. We have a gun violence problem, but it isn't up to the court to sort of do away with the Second Amendment. How would you have responded to that?
Well, first I would have to say I agree with Justice Scalia. It's not up to the court to do away with the Second Amendment. But the reality is that it is up to the court to interpret the Second Amendment, and interpretations of constitutional texts are notoriously policy-driven. If you read all of the briefs, and there were many filed in this case, there were strong textual and originalist arguments on both sides. Obviously, a person deciding the correct interpretation of the Constitution had to choose between those two. And something other than the text or originalism would be the motivating factor, some policy judgment. So Justice Scalia and the majority made a policy judgment to interpret the Second Amendment in a particular fashion. Having done that, then of course they have to enforce it in the fashion in which they interpreted it. But they did make a choice, and there was a choice. So in a way, Justice Scalia's statement is a bit of a subterfuge. Yes, we can't write the Second Amendment out of the Constitution, but in fact, we can interpret it according to, in part, our policy judgment as to what it ought to mean.
So would you say, Professor Ides, that in a sense this was not a quote-unquote conservative decision, that it wasn't a strict constructionist decision, that in a way it was guided more by policy?
I think it was guided more by policy. It was guided by a couple of things, among them a perception that most Americans believe that they have an individual right to bear arms. And in this sense, it was very similar to the abortion decision in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, where a liberal majority of the court essentially understood that most Americans thought a woman had a right to choose to have an abortion. And in both cases, the majority of the court said, but subject to reasonable regulation. So I think Justice Scalia's opinion, having made his policy judgment, then is a very careful opinion that kind of limits the scope of the policy judgment to reasonable regulations.
And to our callers, Ken in New Jersey, joining us on the Sirius Satellite Network, is first up this morning. Ken, go ahead.
Yes. Well, first off, let me just say, I am a gun owner. I do believe in reasonable gun laws. But I find it interesting that since the ban in Washington, D.C. went into effect, they've had a dramatic rise in their violent crimes, while the national average has gone down when 40 states alone have concealed carry laws. And I just find it odd that they're arguing that taking away the right for people to legally purchase and own and keep in their own homes guns is somehow a bad or evil thing. And and I think as far as how the Constitution goes and how it was written, I mean, it was written by a group of men who actually advocated the violent overthrow of what they perceived as a tyrannical government. So I'm kind of curious as to, you know, what the expert's take is on that, and I'll get my answer on my Sirius because I was able to pause it, and love the program. Thank you.
All right, Ken. Thanks for the call from New Jersey this morning. On Kent's first point, Kamala Harris, what's your read on that question?
Well, I think he raises a good point, which is that crime is a function of many factors, and a gun is a tool to commit a crime, but the reason that people commit crime are varied, and they relate to the economic state of that environment and that city. It relates to environmental issues in terms of everything from what's happening in terms of their education level. Did they drop out of school? You know, I know that we did an assessment of the homicide victims in San Francisco over the last 5 years who were under the age of 25, and 94% of them were high school dropouts. That's a factor. It's a factor that most of the people we see in the county jail are almost half are functionally illiterate. We know that most people who are in prison have never had a job. So there are many factors that are connected to an increase or a decrease in crime. And I think what we do want to consider is, again, the statistic that tells us that as many as 80% of the homicides we see are committed with guns. And so we know guns are being used in a very dangerous way. And frankly, the reality is that, you know, at least in San Francisco, we don't exactly have deer and ducks roaming the streets. So when people are walking around carrying guns, it's not for a good purpose.
And Eugene Follick, this gets us into, of course, this tricky and difficult question of not only whether or not this is about policy versus law, but whether or not certain policies are going to impact things like crime statistics. I have to say I'm not familiar with the statistics Ken cited about whether or not homicides in D.C. have gone up or not. But what's your take on that, on the role of the law in particular, when you're trying to figure out what it is that can drive down gun homicides?
Well, I think that, first of all, let me mention, I think that the that Ms. Harris's comments were quite telling. She was saying that most people in San Francisco don't use their guns for hunting, quite right. So therefore, when somebody's walking around with a gun, that's not going to be for a good purpose. That assumes that self-defense is not a legitimate purpose. In 40 of the 50 states, actually, any law-abiding citizen can get a license to carry a gun concealed and can use it for defensive purposes. What's more, the city of San Francisco's view seems to be that even possessing it in your own home is not a good purpose, even if you want to do it for self-defense, that self-defense is not a legitimate purpose to own a gun, at least if you're on a public housing project. So one of the things I think that we're seeing real rejection by the pro-gun ban forces of the notion that self-defense is a legitimate purpose to use lethal force.
Let me get the district,
especially handguns.
Yeah, sorry to interject, but let me get the district attorney to respond on that particular point and challenge.
You know, when we talk about guns, you know, and the Second Amendment, I think all too often the conversation turns into a debate, and it's, you know, all or nothing. That is not our position, and certainly when I, along with 17 other elected district attorneys throughout the country, submitted our brief before the Supreme Court on this case, our point was a very subtle, perhaps, but simple point. When we interpret the Second Amendment, one, as the court did, let's acknowledge that it is not an absolute right. And our point was, understanding that, let us also acknowledge that there is a real public safety implication to where we are and what we decide should be the availability of guns and who should be able to own them and possess them and where. And let's not neglect that very important point, because as district attorneys, we see an incredible amount of crime being committed with guns. And they are guns often that were legally purchased at one time that end up on the streets in the hands of criminals.
But is it a legitimate purpose, District Attorney Harris, to have a gun for self-defense purposes?
I believe that every person should be able to defend themselves if they are in danger. Absolutely. That's not the point we're making. But I think every reasonable person would agree with that. That's not the issue. The issue is that we have a very large number of guns on the streets that are being used in connection with crime and are being used in a way that is killing people.
But if it's reasonable to have self-defense as a legitimate purpose and a gun to aid in that purpose, then wouldn't it also be reasonable for someone in a public housing project to have that right?
If we carry the self-defense argument to its logical conclusion, we could pretty much end the conversation and just say, let's let everybody strap an AK-47 to themselves and walk around, you know, as they get on the train to go to work and pick up their coffee. At some point we have to figure out where there's going to be a balance.
And back to our callers. Jason in San Francisco joins us next. Jason, go ahead. You're on.
Yeah, I had a couple of quick comments. I live in Northwest in Washington, D.C., and recently, about 4 months ago, someone walked up in my back alley where I park my car behind my home, pulled a gun on me, robbed me, threatened to kill me, and then ran away. And I'd love to know how having a gun in my house is going to protect me from some kid trying to kill me in my back alley. And secondly, I think this is a great philosophical debate, but the problem is I live in D.C., and people are dying in D.C., and this is not a philosophical debate, and this is not an interesting conversation. People are dying in our city, and every single day because of illegal guns and people getting a hold of them. And putting more guns in the mix is not going to calm things down.
Jason, thanks.
I had one more other quick comment.
Yeah, briefly, please.
80% of the people in our city do not want guns in our city. And I find it funny that the people that funded this whole legal court system are from outsiders and political people trying to gain points with gun lobbyists, where only several people in the district were asking for this law.
Jason, thanks for the call and the observation. I want to go to Alan Ives on this, but first, Kamala Harris, back to you on that point, because this is some of where you see it. You're on the ground dealing with all this stuff, and you would like the freedom, I suspect, to be able to do what you think you need to do in order to keep San Francisco safe.
Absolutely right. And the caller, and you could hear the emotion and the outrage that he's experienced living in a community where he's experiencing this kind of crime. And the reality is just that there are guns. You know, a kid on the streets of San Francisco and many other places in this country can probably get a gun easier than they can get a library pass. Okay? So let's just acknowledge that and then figure out, working backward, how are we going to minimize the ability of that kid to get that gun on a street corner?
Help us work backwards then, Alan Ides, on that point. If that's the reality, that 80 people die in this country every day because of guns, if that's the reality that the caller spoke to from us, that Kamala Harris has to contend with, how do you work from that reality and craft a way to contend with this that will now meet the standard established by the Supreme Court?
Okay, first, let me just say preliminarily, I think San Francisco should make it easier for kids to get library cards. but... Look, what the Supreme Court has done is not involved in a philosophical discussion. Ultimately, what it has done is said, we're taking one thing off the table, absolute bans on the possession of guns in the home for self-defense. That's off the table. But politicians, district attorneys, you can get together and devise a system that reasonably regulates the possession of weapons in a way that advances the interest in cutting down on gun violence. So perhaps there need to be more resources put on the illegal sale of guns, different approaches to registering and background checks, more thorough background checks, as we saw needed in the state of Virginia. So I think this actually leads to not a philosophical discussion, but a very pragmatic discussion in which interested parties can sit down at the table and say, okay, what can we do to address these problems within the range of options made available by the Supreme Court? And Professor Volokh and I will probably disagree on some things as to what constitutes being reasonable, and courts will have to referee that to a certain extent. But I think what this decision invites is actually a rational political discussion and political solution that will take some time to work out the rough edges.
Let's pick up on one of the points that Alan Ives mentioned, and Eugene Volokh, your response on that, which is the question of background checks. What I've read so far is the sense that that's likely to stand, that that's not something that will necessarily go away because of the Supreme Court ruling yesterday. Do you read it that way, and that states like California that have background check requirements, or as Professor Ives suggested, there may need to be more scrupulous background checks given what happened at Virginia Tech a year ago, that those are likely to stand and that won't be threatened by this decision?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, that background checks are the kind of relatively modest gun restriction that I think courts will easily uphold. Just as I said, such checks are present in very many states that have individual right to bear arms clearly in their constitution. Of course, if the background check takes 6 months, as I understand it may be the case in New York City, where I'm told it's very, very difficult to get a handgun license, that may be an undue burden, an excessive burden on the right. But if it's a relatively modest and quick background check to make sure that somebody's not a felon or insane or otherwise legally disabled, disabled from possessing a gun, of course that's going to be upheld. I want to take a moment, if you don't mind, because I think there are some things that were said earlier that need a response. First of all, Ms. Harris says that we shouldn't think of the Second Amendment as an absolute right, and I agree entirely. But what she's defending is an absolute denial of the right. Indeed, there are permissible regulations on the right, but if you ban all gun ownership by people in public housing projects, you're absolutely denying them this right. You can't have it both ways and say, well, we support self-defense rights, and of course any reasonable person would recognize the right for people to be able to effectively defend themselves, and at the same time deny to people the one tool that they need in order to defend themselves. The caller from Washington, D.C., I'm very sorry about his having been robbed. I've been robbed myself. Both of us were robbed by felons who are committing felonies, who likely had long criminal records, and who, in his case, by definition, must have gotten the gun illegally or must have brought it into D.C. illegally. Gun control law did not help him because, in fact, armed robbers are going to, when they're willing to violate armed robbery law, they're going to be willing to violate gun laws as well. What gun control does do is it disproportionately disarms the otherwise law-abiding, the people who care about the law and are willing to follow the law. They follow the law. They're in their homes. They don't have a gun. Somebody breaks into their home, and now they're unable to defend themselves. So that's the problem. If you could somehow wave your magic wand and all guns vanished in the country, then we might have at least as a practical matter a different kind of debate. You might still have a constitutional debate, but as a practical matter you might say, well, maybe better off for us to be disarmed when the criminals are disarmed as well. But the fact is the criminals aren't going to be disarmed. There are over 200 million guns in the country. Even if you ban the manufacture or production of any new ones, you're still going to have lots of criminals with lots of guns. The practical criminological question, setting aside for another constitutional issue in which I think Justice Scalia interpreted the text quite correctly, but the practical criminological question is, what do you do that tries to fight the gun possession by the criminals without unduly restricting people's law-abiding citizens' ability to defend themselves against criminals who will, no matter what you do, many of the criminals will have guns?
Let me hold you there and get Kamala Harris to respond on how this will now perhaps change the focus of what you do. You won't be in the position of defending or this sort of challenge. I assume the city attorney will actually do that. But is this going to change your job, change the focus of what you have to do in the district attorney's office? Will it change the sort of resources that you have to use to fight the gun crimes that you're concerned about?
It won't substantially change what we've been doing, but what we do, a great deal of our focus is on prosecuting gun crime. We have over the last few years, you know, exponentially increased our conviction rates around convicting, you know, criminals owning and possessing guns, and it is a very big focus of the work we do as district attorneys and as we do here in San Francisco. That's not going to change. But again, on the broader level, we are talking about where we are as a community and as a society on this issue, and to that extent, that is changing, clearly, and there's going to be a lot of conversation and debate about that.
Let's go through some of our emails, see if we can get a couple of quick legal responses to questions our listeners have. David writes, does the public who owns and manages the housing project have the right to prohibit guns in the units, as opposed to whether or not I, as a private landlord, have the right to prohibit guns in my rental unit? Alan Ives, can you respond to that?
I don't quite understand the question in the sense that the public as owner, I think Professor Volokh addressed this and is quite correct, that if it is the public that owns it, the idea that we would allow the public owner of the housing project to violate Fourth Amendment rights should be equally offended if we would allow them to violate Second Amendment rights. And also, one thing that hasn't been mentioned that troubles me, if we say that we can have a ban on ownership or possession in public housing, what we're really saying is that the wealthy can defend themselves, but the poor can't, and particularly the poor in high-crime areas. So I think that would be very troubling and difficult for a court to uphold this kind of a ban in light of those factors.
Here's another call from Lance. Does the requirement to secure firearms in one's home constitute a seizure of property? So I guess this gets into the question, and just a brief response, if you would, Professor Volokh, on whether or not something like a lockbox or a trigger lock constitutes a seizure of property.
No,
The government can require you to lock up your alcohol, can require you to lock up a lot of things. If there is some limit on that, it would be imposed not by property rights, which generally are quite heavily regulable, but by the right to bear arms, which is expressly constitutionally guaranteed, as opposed to the right to use one's property, which is not expressly constitutionally guaranteed.
There are a couple of people writing in about this question of incorporation that we started out with Kamala Harris on whether or not what happened in D.C. will apply because it's a federal entity to cities and states. People wondering about that. Can you respond to that concern and whether or not there's a difference between whether it applies to cities versus unincorporated areas versus states, that kind of thing?
Well, Washington, D.C. Is not a state. It is so the government there is governed more by federal law than they don't have state law per se. So the issue, as I think it was the first your first guest outlined, is unique to D.C. in terms of the federal jurisdiction issue.
And could they decide, could one thing be decided that it applies to cities but not to states, or is it likely to go with both? In other words, could the court ruling apply to San Francisco but not the state of California?
Well, it depends on what's being attacked in terms of litigation that apparently is going to be initiated by the NRA. From everything I hear, they plan on attacking local legislation, which was promulgated as an ordinance here in San Francisco.
Back to our callers. Robert in San Jose joins us next. Robert, go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I read yesterday that even though Justice Scalia decided the Second Amendment would be an individual right, he may not be all that keen in incorporating it into the 14th Amendment. I was wondering if some of the dissenting justices might be more likely to be willing to incorporate the Second Amendment into the 14th Amendment.
Okay, Robert, thank you. Alan Ice, can you take that up and give us, please, a layman's description of the 14th and how the two might connect?
Yes. The Bill of Rights, of which the Second Amendment is a part, applies literally only to the federal government. But over a process that has gone on for over 100 years, the Supreme Court has taken parts of the Bill of Rights and incorporated them through the 14th Amendment Due Process Clause to be applied against the states. So technically, the First Amendment freedom of speech only limits the federal government. But by virtue of the 14th Amendment, which limits state governments, the freedom of speech now applies to the states. So the question is, should the Second Amendment be incorporated into the 14th Amendment so it also applies against the states? And if it applies against the states, it applies against local governments. They're treated as one entity for purposes of the 14th Amendment. So that's an interesting question. Justice Scalia, being an originalist and a textualist, might actually have difficulty saying that it was the intent of the framers of the 14th Amendment to incorporate the Second Amendment. My guess is that since I don't really think he is an originalist, he'll get over that hurdle quite easily. But if we were to be hyper-technical about this, someone such as a Clarence Thomas or a Scalia who believed in a strict interpretation of the Constitution might have a little difficulty finding that this part of the Bill of Rights was intended to be incorporated against the states. Ultimately, though, I think the court will find that it was.
Alan Ives, professor of constitutional law at Loyola Law School in Los Angeles. Let's return to the sort of day-to-day, nitty-gritty level of this, Kamala Harris, and sort of where we go from here. You're known, of course, as a strong supporter of the Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama, who seemed to give a kind of nuanced response to the court's decision yesterday, I think it's fair to say. He said that he appreciated the fact that the court's decision would lend some guidance to cities. Do you wish that he had come out stronger against it, given the kind of passion with which you feel we need to inject into fighting gun crime?
I mean, I think that Barack Obama made a statement. He was clear about his position on it, and I believe that his position, as stated, was well thought out.
But where do you want us to go from here? I mean, what do you think we need to be reminded of as a society, given what you see the stakes as being?
Well, I can speak, you know, obviously on behalf of myself as a career prosecutor, and I feel very strongly that, again, that this issue of what we should do about guns, it often is it takes on a very it's polarized in terms of where people stake their positions, and it's either all or nothing, and we can't afford to allow this conversation to just look that way, because the reality is there is a very big area in between, and in that area we are seeing guns being used by criminals to rob people, to assault people, to shoot and paralyze people, and kill innocent people. And we have to, as a civil society, agree that there has to be regulation. And the regulation not only applies to the criminal in the course of committing the crime, but has to also apply to what we can do to prevent that from happening. And that means regulating guns in a way that we can ensure that the criminal is not going to get the gun to use it to commit a crime.
And we just have 30 seconds left, Eugene Follick, so let me offer you a last response to that. Given the day-to-day reality that Kamala Harris has to contend with, your response on how we can best contend with gun crime within the ramifications of what the court ruled yesterday.
Punish the gun criminals. Punish people who and deter people who use guns to commit crimes. You're not going to be able to disarm them short of throwing them in jail or making the punishment for the crime so great that they're not going to possess it. And you shouldn't try to disarm law-abiding citizens. If there are modest restrictions on law-abiding citizens, then that might be worth doing. But you have to recognize law-abiding citizens need guns in order to be able to defend themselves against criminals who are going to have them in any event. One other thing I want to mention about Professor Ives' point, actually there's very strong evidence from the late 1860s that the framers of the 14th Amendment intended to incorporate the right to keep and bear arms. It's mentioned several times in the course of debates about the 14th
And we're going to have to end our constitutional law lesson there, I'm afraid, Professor Volek. Thanks very much for being part of our program. Thanks, too, to Alan Ides, who joined us as a professor of constitutional law at Loyola Law School, and to Kamala Harris, district attorney for San Francisco. Thanks all very much for participating this morning. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.